joining. I'm Paul Levitz. I'm moderating on the excuse that I have a book coming out this fall, Little Eyes of a Champion, the graphic novel, which I will be showing you endlessly through this panel in various connections. We will be joined, if he makes it here, by Jeff Smith. I understand he's being attacked by red dragons in our hall, but a little bit of luck, there'll be a grandmother coming by to kill the dragon and let him come through. Next to the invisible Jeff Smith, we have the highly visible Sergio Aragonés, who has promised not to do this panel in mine, but to use his customary brewish charming.
Thank you.
To keep us from being too marginal in the event. Beyond him, we have Dennis Kitchen, who has a lifetime of lengthy credits, but most salient perhaps to this, having been Will Eisner's good friend, publisher, art agent, and perhaps the person who most corrupted him into moving from the convention world into being part of the creative world again. And Brandon did save you. Excellent. Come on. Jeff Smith of the wonderful world of Bone and Razzle and other good stuff. And apparently a serious boy crush on Sergio.
He's older when you're around.
I know your taste. It's a whole other question. And finally, holding down the far end, Danny Figueroff, author of books like Superman on the Couch, Stan Lee Universe, longtime Marvel writer and editor in his day, and patron saint of Will Eisner Week, often, along with our hosts in many ways, Carl and Nancy Gropper from the Eisner Family Foundation that keeps Will's name in front of the public so much and manages to convince the Comic-Con and other places to give as much time to this. So I invite you guys here to argue with me, because really I don't get enough crap. This year, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Spirit at Comic-Con, which is wonderful. We've had a lot of panels focusing on that. The starting point that I wanted to talk about and to sort of get reactions to is I think the Spirit, wonderful as it is not Will's most important contribution to the field. I actually don't think any of the wonderful graphic novels that he did are the most important contribution either as books. I think they're most important for the effect they had on some of us and others in the creative community. That it's Will's behavior as an evangelist who was consistently seeking more respect for the medium of comics that really is the most lasting contribution. There's a famous line about the architect Christopher Wren in England, that beautiful cathedral that he's involved in part of it, and his tome has written on it, "If you seek his monument, look about you." In a sense, the state of this convention is in many ways a monument to what Will envisioned, the range of people who are enjoying comics in their graphic novel form, in their periodical form, in their digital form, and the range of creative people doing interesting work today. So that's my proposition. Arguments in favor, arguments against, simple yes and no, not acceptable.
I think you should write a book on that topic.
Well, what you said about the Spirit not being the most important part, I know how important the graphic novel is, but when I was a kid in the 40s, the Spirit was the most important thing that I ever saw in my life. I grew up in Mexico, and it came translated. So I assumed that it was a good translation because I loved it. So it must have been some good. And what amazed me about the Spirit then is that in such a short time, he could convey a whole story with humor, with seriousness, with action. It was amazing. And this is a kid in the third grade, just fascinated by the Spirit compared to every other comic that it was in arriving to our hands. So to me, that was the important part.
Did you see it as a comic book or as a newspaper supplement?
As an insert in a Mexican comic book called Paquito, which had a lot of very bad art, by the way, but it had bad, and then there was spirit. It was like an explosion of incredible talent. It was just amazing. And I'm talking, what, 40? In the 40s, you know, very early 40s, mid 40s, late 40s, no, around that. But yeah, it was a great, the spirit was to me.
I don't think that Will could have been the evangelist and the popularizer if the work wasn't important, right? I mean, it's sort of, in a way, putting the cart before the horse. If people didn't love and admire the work, why would they listen to what he thought about the medium and how it could grow and change?
Dennis, you're nodding quiet.
Well, I think Danny makes a good point. I mean, who wants to listen to just an evangelist, right? I'm not quite as old as Sergio, but I remember as a young man, my eyes popping out when I first saw the spirit in Harvey Kurtzman's Help magazine back around 61, I think, and he reprinted one of the sans serif stories from 1950, and it was so different and so beautiful. I just remember thinking, I have to find more of these, and it was very difficult to find them, and that was the first genesis in my mind that this ought to be reprinted. And a few years later, I tried to do something about it. But again, it's that same spark, I think, that Sergio described. It hadn't been like anything else I had seen before in comics, and I had to have more. Of course, by the time the graphic novels came out, I was older and jaded, and still it was a remarkable thing. And so, yes, that's somebody I would then see in an evangelistic view, but first came discovery, and I can't look at it as objectively as, say, someone who came along when he was already there.
10 years later, I discovered Will Eisner in the Warren reprints, the kind of oversized black and white reprints of the stuff from the 40s, and so we're talking here 30 years later, and it blew my mind, and I was used to reading Kirby and Neil Adams and Bernie Wrights, and I saw the spirit stuff, and I was taken by it immediately by a number of factors. One was just the way he moved the characters panel to panel. You don't really give this much credence, but or people don't think about it very much, is what I should say, that with the way you move your story through one panel to the next, and then to the next, or however you do it, it has to be a very natural, organic flow, and I never saw anybody do it quite like that up at that time. I mean, Neil Adams and Steranko were experimenting with, like, you know, drawing faces with the panels, you know, and having things flip around, and it was very formalistic and exciting, although it was terrible comics, because you couldn't follow it. But then I read The Spirit, and it was like, I mean, you knew exactly what was going on the whole time. It was funny, it was exciting, it was tense, and it had, I can't say it was the first I ever saw this, because Dick Tracy comics used to do this, but where something happened in one adventure, like he got shot in the legs, I think, and then in the next adventure, he wasn't all back together, he was actually having complications, and there was danger, do you remember this story? There was a danger that his legs were going to be amputated, and I was like terrified. I was like 13 years old going, oh my God, no, he's going to lose his legs. And I actually think that sense of believability and continuity seems so natural to me in retrospect that's the guy who started to do long form novels, that he kind of believed in the art form itself and wanted to give us graphic novels.
One of the things that you guys touched on, using different language, is about his sheer level of craft. When you look back on his first generation peers, you had some wonderfully inspired artists, but the form was very new. There wasn't a lot to learn from when you're talking about scaling up to a page. the comic strip guys included some brilliant talent, but relatively few of them had used the page as a whole. You know, Winsor McKay and some other interesting early experiments, certainly. Moving from panel to panel in the way he did the acting, some of the things that Will was really good at, civilians don't have any terminology for. Kids don't have any terminology for. You call it a spark, you call it a magic when you're looking at it. As an aspiring artist, maybe you began to be able to put words to it. I think there's a challenge for the younger generation downstairs when they look at Will's work and they see so much talent in it, but they don't see how outrageous that craft was at the time it was done, to put it into the context of it.
That's when you start comparing what it was. And when I met Will many, many years ago, it was it's incredible meeting somebody who did that art when you were young. And then you met the man, you understand where he comes from, all his work, the people who work with him, the military thing, and suddenly you read a graphic novel when the man should be retired. And then you see his life in it. You can see where he grew up. You know, when it's a whole universe of being able to do his life, convey it to people who are strangers, and make a beautiful graphic novel.
Right.
You said no mind, Sergio.
Just amazing.
I would add, when you say the average fan doesn't have a language for that craft, I think most of the people, certainly in this audience, most of the people even at the convention, read a lot of books, a lot of different literature. They know the difference between, you know, ordinary writing and a high craft of writing. Brilliant writing certainly stands out from pedestrian writing. The difference with Will back in his day, in the 40s, was the word he used was pretensions. He had pretensions of being artistic and literary, when his contemporaries were literally telling him, people like Rube Goldberg would say, "We're just here to sell newspapers, kid. Don't be so pretentious." But Will was, and he didn't see that as a bad thing, to be pretentious. And so I think the same way you can look back and see Citizen Kane and know that at its time, it was very different. And people today have to look at it in the context of the period and to see how innovative and how great it was. It still is. And the same with Will. It's still great. But at its time, it was unique.
I think some of the challenge with getting the young people to understand and appreciate it is that Will is justifiably on such a pedestal that it's almost like eating your spinach. Like, it's good for you. You know, we do realize it's good for you. And so people, I think a lot of people come to it with almost a hostile attitude. Prove it to me. You know, make me believe that it's really, that's really relevant to me in 2015. You know? But I think there is that aspect of, you know, all the great books we've never read because it's like, everybody says, "Read those books, I'm not going to read them," or, you know, something like that.
I think that's a fair question that you're raising, Danny. When Charlie Kochman at Abrams started me on this book project, the first incarnation was, we've got our book on Kurtzman, thanks to Dennis. We have our book on Kirby, thanks to Mark Evanier. From Charlie's point of view, and I think from the point of view of many of us, Will was the third of the great influential artists in the field. It starts getting more challenging arguing who the fourth, fifth, and sixth are. Not that there weren't perhaps equally brilliant artists, but as a question of massive influencers of people who would follow, those three guys were enormously powerful in the ripples they put through our history. And Charlie said, "You know, give me the text for the book on the art of Will Eisner." And I refused because you're right about the spinach issue. There's a half-life to how long we focus on particular artists. I thought the job was to try to position Will in history in a way that showed his effect, that made him particularly relevant to what's going on now. We're living in this incredible moment of graphic novels, ranging from the explosion of kids' stuff that in many ways Bone began about a decade ago when it went out to Scholastic and started to reach a wider audience, and that Raina's work is accelerating enormously right now with the reach of what's going on there, Raina Telemager and her books. The range of new creators that are coming into the field with such wide expressive voices, followed by new readers who are interested in what they're doing. So I wanted to connect Will into that story. And to me, that was why we came to the title of Champion of the Graphic Novel. And just to show you a little bit of the book, obviously we have a couple of spirit stories in it, which is wonderful. We have a lot of things shot from the precious originals that Dennis has treasured and taken careful. Things don't go away that fast. Things that people haven't seen for years. For about 3 minutes in the late 1940s, Will decided to be a publisher, one of the few strategic mistakes in his career. And baseball comics was one of the two things that he actually made it to the stands at that moment. Will had a long period of work that is essentially invisible to the world today, doing commercial comics for communication. And we found these wonderful things like office machines you can use as a job, adding machines, all these things that in the 60s were important teaching tools for people. The graphic novels themselves, the fun he had with the world of conventions, and becoming more involved in this. Lots of great original artwork. And things like this that showed that evolution. The storytelling here is from 1941. And that's outrageous for this period. That's not real. When you pull the story together, I think pretension is one of the words. I think the other word that I really look to in connecting Will's story is his search for respect. Now, he was a first-generation Jewish immigrant kid from a poor family. They were all poor families at that point, basically. It was not a respected ethnicity on the streets of New York. My tribe were not the toughest kids floating around. We were the newest group off the boat. The newest group off the boat always gets a disproportionate amount of crap wherever they've come from. Still going on today, sadly. And I think Will was looking through most of his career for a personal level of respect. That's why the newspaper supplement became important to him, because newspaper cartoonists were more respected than comic book cartoonists. It's why I think the commercial comics and the work for the Army became important to him at a time when he got married and his father-in-law was saying, why don't you become a stockbroker and get a real job?
Sounds familiar.
No artist around here have ever heard a story like that. So he put a suit and a tie on and made a business out of it. And then his quest to get the graphic novels treated with respect. Personal respect was important, respect for the form was important, and it became a lifelong quest, and it benefited the rest of us tremendously.
He had an attitude, too, that was very infectious. The way he approached us younger cartoonists, or really probably anyone he met, but particularly my generation, which was the self-publishers and the indies, we really looked up to him because he kept his copyrights, was part of it. But he also engaged with us and he projected an aura of civility. He wanted, that's not the right sentence, that's what I'm saying. Do you know what I'm saying?
Dignity.
He thought we should all treat each other with civility because there are a lot of different demarcation lines in comics. You know, you like Marvel, so you don't like DC. or
you like Stan, you like Stan, you don't like Jack.
Right.
You
know, exactly.
Arguing about which one.
Yeah. You don't
more
like
that day.
Superheroes. You know what I mean? You can only like. There's so many like lines in the sands in comics, and Will didn't really go for that at all. He was just like, comics is comics, and it really does all come down to the art form. And he believed so much in the art form. And he, you know, some of us would feud. He would kind of scold us a little bit. Now, scold might be a little hard, but I got in a big fight, a big public fight with my friend Dave Sim at one point. And I saw Will at that next San Diego and just walking through the halls, walking through the convention hall. And he grabbed me around the shoulder. And he goes, what's this with you and Dave? What's going on? I want you to stop it right now. I guess that's scolding.
It's being parental about it.
Yeah. And he also had a... there's also another thing that I don't know if... I didn't really get this from Will, but I clicked with him about it. And that was that... And this is what made me think of what you just said. He didn't think he was better than anybody else. I mean, me too. But he didn't think anybody was better. So, you know what I mean? So he's doing comics, and he didn't think the comics were better than, like, the fine arts or prose literature, but he sure didn't think that those things were better than comics. Hmm. And I completely share that opinion.
Yeah, it's a world that sometimes a lot of people try to separate and make comics, cartoons, this... In many other countries, the comic strip, for instance, doesn't exist. Many Europeans who invented the form, Germany and many other countries, have maintained what the humor in magazine, cartoons, or newspapers, completely different, but not comic strips. The comics in Europe were completely an American invention. You know, they love it, and they start doing European comics. And in my case, I love humor. That's what I come from humor, magazine cartooning. I couldn't publish humor in the States because there was no humor in comics. There were humor in comics in Europe. They had Asterix, Lucky Luke, Tintin, all the humor comics. Here they had teenager humor, funny animals humor thing. So it was difficult. But Will, you know, in the private conversations, he said that humor could be completely used for comics. That before I did the comics. Mm-hmm. And he was really one of the guys who invited me to do humor in comics.
Well, that would be good.
Thank you, Will.
Well, Paul and I go many years, and he remembered in D.C. there was no humor in the comics.
No.
You know? I remember
the years you had Bruce sitting in a drawer.
Not intentionally.
Find a home for him.
That's correct. That's correct. That's true. So Will has been, to me, such an incredible influence in many, 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 many ways.
I knew Will a little, probably the least of anybody on this panel. Literally 20 years ago when he was doing the Spirit Screensaver with Byron Price, and I was working for Byron. I was basically sitting at the Price booth at the con and kind of going, meet Will Eisner, you know, and he took that in good humor. He was much nicer to me than he had any need to be. He was like the opposite of a rock star style comic book prima donna. He just gave of his time and of his opinions and, you know, I mean, he, you know, wrote a blurb for a book I wrote about superheroes when he didn't care for superheroes and barely knew me. But it was like, sure, I'll, you know, I mean, it was stuff like that. Was Will just, I think, reaching out and being open and treating everybody like an equal? It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, you know, another aspect of that was he loved to discover and nurture new talent. I can tell you, one year I had Kitchen Sink Press was still around. I had a booth, and he was at my booth, and he went off wandering, and a while back he came back, and he literally grabbed my shoulder, and he said, come here, I got to show you something. And he dragged me several hours away where this kid had a booth set up who had just self-published Bone. I think he had maybe two issues out. And Will said, this is great. He said, look at this stuff. We got to help this kid. And I looked at it and I said, "Ah, this."
Yeah, we can do that.
No, but that's the way he was. He loved using his eye to discover new talent because he had an eye for what was good, and then he would help. He didn't have to help.
Dennis is one of the first. There was a group that did humor in the United States. It was called the Underground. That's the first time humor appeared as a comic book form, I think.
Really?
Yeah, because then before, okay, Archie for teenagers, the animals that fly and talk, and that's a lot of fun. But that's children, more or less children stuff. But humor...
Let me make the distinction a different way, Sergio. It's the question of humor without using genre as a crutch. The whether it was the Archies or the funny animal stuff, it was all built on a very strong formulaic set of tools. Mm. Whereas the undergrounds became a kind of free expressive humor.
Adult.
Yeah.
For people who discern better. So to me, that was the big opening of humor in the States.
And our big hero was Harvey Kurtzman, of course, with Mad. But if you look at what Harvey has said in interviews, one of his deep influences was Will Eisner, who was doing humor in the 40s and influencing Harvey. So it's all very connected.
To Will?
Yeah.
I mean, all of these pole stars of our creative universe influenced each other in some fashion or another. Will and Harvey teaching in separate classrooms at SVA for a bunch of years and arguing about how to teach with each other and sharing their different points of view. And for much of that time, Art Spiegelman down the hall from him with yet a third point of view. And the astounding possibility of the students who were exposed to all of them. One of the things that was fascinating in doing the book was trying to track those ripples out. The extreme of which was one of my kids' girlfriends gave me a collection of Nelson Mandela cartoons by South Africa's leading editorial cartoonist for Christmas, and I'm pawing through it, and wonderful work. Man signs his work Zapiro, and I discovered that, in fact, he was a student of Will's and Harvey's at SVA, and this beautiful cartoon of his in the book representing it. You see the effect that Will had as a teacher, that he had it also as a codifier of all of these forms. And one of the other things that makes him distinct from Harvey and from Jack is he set down a lot of the logic. He was one of the first of the cartoonists to do the books about how to do it and to really teach it in this kind of structured fashion.
Or to even think that there was a way to do it.
Yeah.
I think people just looked at it and thought that it's like a coloring book. It just happened, and then cartoonists did it in the morning, and then they went golfing in the afternoon.
That's what we do.
only the ones as fast as you are, Sergio.
Yeah.
I clocked him at 22 minutes for a page, script, pencil, and ink once.
22 minutes? Jesus.
Literally sitting at a desk in the office.
He's drawing, he's inking one right here with his feet.
Yeah.
It's really illegal to be that talented.
Well, I can tell a couple kind of personal stories. This is about like his humbleness, or he didn't like to be made too much of him. And I'll tell you two stories. The first one was the very first time I was nominated for an Eisner Award, I brought a suit and a tie. Because I thought, oh, it's an award ceremony. And I dressed up in a suit and tie. And I got there, and everybody's in stuff like Sergio. Hawaiian shirts and shorts and T-shirts. And I was kind of embarrassed. You know, I was like, I'm the only guy. And I had a tie on and everything, a suit. I even bought the suit for this. And
You still have the suit?
I do, but it doesn't fit. And I went up on stage, and at that time, Will actually stood on stage and handed you the plaque personally and shook your hand. And he actually thanked me he liked wearing the suit. In fact, I have a picture of me in the suit with you, Sergio, and Will.
I'm wearing a suit?
Yes. No, I don't think so. But he thanked me for wearing the suit. And then about And more people dress up a little bit more at the Eisner's these days. So I took it another level, to the next level, and I wore a tux one year. And he got mad at me. You look like a monkey. You got a monkey suit. Get that off. So he was like, yeah, do it. Dress yourself. Be respectful. Don't go too far, kid. So then the second story. Will used to stand on stage all night. And, he was 70 years old, and we're like, he should be on a throne. He shouldn't be standing there like Vanna White. So as a joke, and I knew Will would not dig this, but I got Kurt Busiek, and I got together Jackie Estrada, who runs the Eisner Awards, and I said, where can we get a throne? And just not tell Will, just bring it out in the middle of the award ceremony. She says, I'll take care of it. She went to like a local school or something and found like a prop throne.
San Diego Opera, I think.
Oh my goodness. I mean, it was perfect. I mean, it was like a big King Arthur throne. Kirk and I hid behind the stage, and Will, right in the middle when he was talking, the curtains opened up and we just lifted the thing up, we brought it out, and everybody laughed and applauded, and Will did not want to sit in it, but he had to. We had him. He was trapped. So he sat in it, and we got lots of nice pictures of it. And he got up, and then he never sat in it again. The room just sat empty the rest of the ceremony. Good.
There's a beautiful photograph of Will looking embarrassed in the throne between you and Kurt in the book.
And we have real shit-eating grins on our faces.
As we deserve that one.
Yeah, when I was at the stage giving the Hall of Famer, I dress because he dressed.
Yeah.
And I just bring my suit just for that. You know, I never wear it, except I have the same jacket for about 20-some years.
Yeah. No, you look good. I didn't mean to say for
that. No, that was after. Before, it was just normal, you know. But he got me embarrassed. He dressed so well.
I know.
So I dress for him.
Cool. Let's touch on one more aspect of Will in all of this, which is the degree to which he was specifically a role model. We've talked about his sort of avuncular attitude of talking to the young cartoonists and the young creators in the field, and compared to Will, we were all at one point or another the young cartoonists and creators in the field, and giving us advice.
That was a long time ago.
You're still behind me. But he also, I think, was a very personal role model to a lot of us on different issues. His personal relationships as well as his professional relationships.
His family relationship with his wife. And that was a sampling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just, on sort of a non-super dramatic but very meaningful level to me, I did an interview with Will for my magazine, Right Now magazine, that I did for Tomorrow's. And so I was focusing on Will as a writer and comics writing. And of course, I read 1,000 interviews, and I sort of challenged myself, could I ask this guy even one question he's never been asked before? I don't know if I succeeded. But we made the appointment like a month in advance, so we would talk at 10:30 on Wednesday morning, October, whatever. And maybe we touch base about it a couple of weeks before. And I've been to this rodeo more than once. You make an appointment to do an interview with somebody, and they got a deadline, they got a family crisis, they got to be somewhere, they forgot they booked a meeting with somebody else. I called Will up at 10:30 on October 26th. Hello, this is Will Eisner, let's go. I just found that really pretty impressive and a great role model. Like, you say you're going to be somewhere, you'll be there.
Right. He took great pride in being punctual and never missing a deadline. He claimed that never in his career did he miss a deadline, and to my experience, he didn't. Very few artists who can claim that.
I definitely did not follow that from him.
But I concur that he was a role model on a number of levels, just as a decent human being. For me, as a businessman, he was a role model. But even as a married man, he was a role model. His wife, Anne, is wonderful, and seeing them interact together was always inspiring. And I had my own marital problems over the years, and Will would counsel me. And, you know, sometimes it helped. By the third time, I finally got it right. But he was a role model there, too. That would have been the next book. But the point is, he was a well-rounded person. And there are a lot of cartoonists I know who are wonderful, and they can talk shop all day with you. But when you stray away from comics, sometimes there are limitations. Maybe they don't follow the news, or they don't follow other parts of culture. Will and Ann did. And you could talk to them about politics. You could talk to them about film and literature and other things. They were well-rounded people. They weren't just interested in talking shop. So those kinds of things are not particularly relevant to most fans, but the point is this was a full human being, and that in itself is inspiring.
And that showed in the work, too. I think part of the humanity of the work comes out of the humanity of the man.
Right.
We have a few minutes to take some questions. Since you guys walked so far, you've certainly earned the right to participate with us.
Was there any competition among the greats like Hogarth and Kurtzman and Eisner? I know there's a kind of a fellowship among them, but artistically or in other ways, is there any kind of...
It's funny you mentioned Hogarth. I have to tell one story.
Yes, Hogarth.
At one point when Will was still in White Plains, he decided to have a soiree where he would invite the intellectual cartoonists he knew. And so people lived in the New York area, and he invited Jules Feiffer and Harvey Kurtzman and Gil Kane, Bern Hogarth, and I'm sure I'm missing one or two. And he wanted this to be a regular thing where they would just talk about deep things. And so they hosted the first evening, and after everybody left, Anne turned to Will and said, referring to Bern Hogarth, "I never want that man in my house again." He tended to be a little pompous.
Well, he had a concept about art that he would talk a lot, but that has nothing to do with Will.
Well, actually, but Hogarth's an interesting question, because in some ways, Hogarth would have been the logical father for the graphic novel at the moment. He had helped found SVA. His publication of the Tarzan original graphic novel forms in the early 70s were a physical effort of publishing that the rest of graphic novels doesn't get to for probably another 15 years for most things. He was certainly as prestigious an artist as there had been in the business, and yet nothing clicked out of that. Bunch of theories about why that might be, but I'd be very curious to hear other people's thoughts, whether it had to do with his personality or whether there was something intrinsic to the choice of what he was working on with the Tarzan project.
I do not have a theory about it. But it was interesting. I bought that Tarzan book as a 15-year-old or whatever, and it really was a very complete
It's a lovely piece of work.
It's a novel. It's an adapted story.
It is a novel, but it's an already established novel. Yeah. It's already been done.
Uh-huh.
The advantage with Will is that this is a novel, original novel. Something that he just came out of his head, never seen before. It's written and it's drawn. Tarzan has been movies, it's been... What was his name?
Elmo Lincoln?
Elmo Lincoln, yeah. It's been done in every medium.
Fly.
That was a collection. But
the voice of the author, that is something Will championed, and that is a concept that really, when you saw Contract with God, that's what jumped out. And that was kind of back to your very first statement, which was, what was important here was the quality level, but also the insistence that the cartoonist be treated as an author, because you're getting the voice and the characters and the ideas of that creator.
One other thing about Bern Hogarth was, I referred earlier to Will consciously having pretensions. Hogarth had pretensions of a different level. At this very convention some years back, he put on a master class, and the title of it was, quote, "How I would have painted the Sistine Chapel." Seriously.
I have an anecdote. It's very quick. I hope you have time. I was in a panel about cartooning, and some I had to go to the bathroom so bad, and I was, and somebody asked about the quality of art, and I see Mr. Hogarth sitting over there, says, "Who better to answer your question?" Ben Hogarth. Ben Hogarth stands up. I go out, go to the bathroom, stop, sign some autographs. Come back, he's still talking. Thank you very much. I continue the conversation. That was good, you know. He'd love to talk.
The last question is
these days, we obviously regard Eisner as a god among mortals.
Yes.
At the time the graphic novels came out, were they popular? How did they sell?
Not too well.
I mean, Contract with God sold only a few thousand copies. The world had no idea how to sell it. There was no retail space. Will repeatedly told stories of going into bookstores, and it was fine if it was on the front table for those first couple weeks. The bookstores will put you in the sort of new and curious spot. But then one bookstore would shelve it under Judaica, another would shelve it under humor, another would say, "I don't know what to do with this," and send it back. Part of the problem there is that it's very difficult to pioneer a category with a single book. There's no home for it. Part of it was that there wasn't a clear audience for it. When Contract with God was first published, 1978, there were somewhere under 1,000 comic shops in the country, the strongest of which was weaker than the average comic shop that we have today. None of them had book sections of any size, because there weren't more than a handful of books. We all owned them that were written about comics. There were very few book collections. So it was kind of a lost puppy. Over the years, it sold a reasonable number of copies as Will's library built up and went through, what I guess, four publishers, Dennis? Baronet, you, me, and then Norton, which does it currently.
Right.
But it was not a stunning commercial success. It was an emotional success for the people who would make the form a success.
I've had many conversations with Frank Miller about this very thing, where us comic book geeks found it. I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and I found it. I probably found it like 79 or 80. And I was like, "Whoa, this is the thickest comic book I've ever seen. This is awesome." And of course, it had a more profound effect than that. But it was also, it had the same effect on Frank. And it only took Frank about 6 more years to do Dark Knight. You know, he did Ronin, and he got on the train right away. It took me about 10 years to get my act together.
You're a little younger.
And so actually, I'm pretty much the same age as you.
A couple years younger than I. Okay.
That was a big effect. That was a real effect. Not the commercial effect.
The black shirt.
So against that background, when you said he's a business person, and against that background of the distribution and precedent, what was the impetus for him to go that direction? Because he had to have a sense for this is going to be a really tough fight. And so if there's a way that you normally do things that's easier to get a story told, what was the impetus to go that very different direction at that time?
He was a stubborn.
Well, he had the financial independence at that point that he could take that gamble that a lot of artists couldn't. So he was willing to devote that time, and had it been an utter failure, he wouldn't have lost his home. I mean, he had sold his business and essentially retired from the other things he was doing. So
it was in many ways, it was a political statement. Not politics in the sense of Hillary versus Jeb kind of nonsense. But political in the sense of, I want this to be my form to be perceived as literature and art. So I'm not going to let this be published. I'm not going to create this in any way that compromises. And he compromised as a businessman. He didn't manage to find a publisher desperately anxious to do it. I mean, it's a a little focused on fact that the early graphic novels that made these transitions were very difficult business propositions. Harvey Kurtzman with Jungle Book, which you can argue, and I would argue, was sort of the first of the modern graphic novels, ends up with terrible reproduction, terrible printing, and no commercial success, so he doesn't go further with it when he does it. Will didn't want any of those mistakes, so he wasn't going to depend on a traditional publisher doing a traditional job. If he had to subsidize the publication in one fashion or another, overtly, covertly, he was going to find the right publisher to do it who would take a chance with him. This was very daring.
The success of the graphic novel or not has nothing to do with the quality of the graphic novel. It has to do with a bad retailing situation of a new product. Happened with the movies in the early century. It happened with a graphic novel. As he said before, there was no place for it on the bookstores. They didn't know what to do it. They still don't know what to do it. They made a special section for comics, and there goes the graphic novel. It's said to be on the westerns or into the graphic novel per se. It still hasn't found a niche because now the bookstores are disappearing. So it came and it didn't have the place to succeed. If they have the graphic novel where it belongs, which is by gender, that this belongs here, belongs there. Not with the comics. The comics, are collections of things that have been published before. The graphic novel, as Will Eisner envisioned it, is much more important.
Well, that was a big battle for us in the 90s, was getting the retailers in the comic book shops to stock graphic novels. They did not want them. They wanted to get a comic in, put it on the shelf. Yep. 4 weeks later, the next issue of Spider-Man goes out. That issue comes down, goes into a long box, never to be seen again except by a collector. and that's it. The model, the way it was, we wanted our comics to be bought and sold over and over again, whereas they wanted to run it like it was a record store where the Beatles' White Album, as soon as the next album came out, that one gets put away and it's never reprinted again. And if you want to hear the White Album, you have to go to a collector's market and pay $20,000 for it. That's the way books are sold. And we used to have, Dave Sim and I used to have these parties in suites at different hotels and invite retailers and have lots of pizza and alcohol. And we would say, guys, this is a high profit margin. You can restock it if it sells out. If Watchmen sells out, you know you're going to sell more. Buy more and put them up there. It's like a hardware store. It's like a hammer. If you sell another hammer, get another hammer. That was a really, really tough fight, and we took a lot of hits over it, but I think we won that one.
I think it did, but part of it was also we changed the distribution system. Part of the problem was at that point, if the retailer wanted more Watchmen, he had to order a box of 18. And it wasn't until we changed the distribution system in 95 to have the publishers take more of the risk of keeping the inventory that we forced the distribution system to be able to sell onesies to the retailer.
Because I was selling onesies straight to the retailer.
But
that blew up in my face in 95, by the way.
Sorry about that. Last question. We'll give it to you if we don't have a fresh hand. Do we have anybody who didn't ask a question who wants one?
Yeah, we talk about the form over here, but I always thought that it struck me weird when I picked it up that the subject matter also was kind of daring for him, because the Jewish culture, by the time A Contract with God came out, was Woody Allen or a Portnoy's Complaint, not the Yiddish theater, not the Shalom Aleichem. I mean, I don't even think people knew what a lot of that stuff was, like Yiddish and Jewish culture and all.
Some of us did.
I didn't. I found out.
The general public, the general public, and then add that the form of everything you were talking about. It's pretty daring, I guess, where you have to go all out. The whole balls out to make it.
Well, that is a luxury you have when you're doing something experimental. Why not do the thing you want to do and the subject matter you want to express?
And it's also a bunch of short stories. It's not really exactly a novel, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
It depends on how you look at it. There's a recent winner of one of the National Book Awards last couple of years, Jennifer Egan, writing the Goon Squad, they're all, it's a series of short stories. They're interconnected because the characters interconnect and the gestalt of it connects. And Will's stories fit together in a fashion that maybe often was only apparent to him. But we can get much too hung up on the definition of what a graphic novel is. Most people in the field will cheerfully agree it's a pretty dumb term. As it's applied in the business world, because you go out to the to Barnes & Noble, which is expanding, bless them, its graphic novel space. I just saw Jim Killen this morning, who's talking about the success there.
That guy.
What would be a better name?
A long comic. I don't know.
I mean, it's comics. It's a big bag of comics.
It's a comic. It's a comic.
No, it's not a comic. Well, it's a graphic comic. Look, it's a graphic comic.
Next year's panel, we will argue over what Barnes & Noble should call their section and what the form should be called.
Graphic novels, comics are silly things.
Certainly, you have a year to prepare your notes. You can moderate next year. Select those of us who want to be on it.
Okay.
We'll invite you all back to be built on Coronado Island. I understand there's a resort there that has pink flamingos wandering around. They will attend and join the argument. They squawk really well. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you.